On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Good afternoon, good evening, good morning, depending on where you are on this little tiny blue-green marble of the time machine hurtling through the universe. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That is where you will find, of course, a selection of the day's news when I haven't been remiss in posting same, or when I haven't spent the day away largely from the studio. The studio, in this case, being the soon-to-be former Capitol Hill headquarters of the IT campaign, we'll be broadcasting from here all the way through Friday, and then heading back to the hills and hollers of West Bicod, Virginia. Also, of course, at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, access to the chat room, which is free and easy, and this being Monday, the room will begin filling up. I mean, you can't really fill up the room, but folks will be wandering in as the time passes. You're welcome to jump right in at your leisure. We get started this evening with a little bit of good news. We are caught up with fundraising for the evening. That was taken care of by Paulie, who did so late on Friday night. And we all really, really appreciate this. Paulie, just out of the blue, Friday evening, took care of fundraising for this evening. He said, let everybody know, hey, Paulie 2222, a.k.a. Paul from Fremont, took care of fundraising for this evening. So thank you. Thank you, Paul. And it serves as an opportunity because, you know, sometimes we don't meet our fundraising goals. This would be a great opportunity to jump in and get out a little bit ahead if anyone is so inclined to do. The PayPal button's at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Also, and so thank you, Paul, for getting us going. His note via his contribution said, "I love this show." Thank you very much. It, the idea of creating community is what this is all about, which is different from the idea with most profit-based broadcasting, which is to create opportunities to send you to purchase products from companies that you may or may not want to do business with. It's rather a significant difference, I think. It is, of course, Memorial Day 2014, and it has been a brutal weekend. Sweet Jesus. More dead people. And I tweeted something a little bit before airtime. I think, and this idea began percolating through my mind, I guess Saturday. Ferg and I went walkabout in D.C. And we happened to, because the D.C. Metro was 17 shades of broken down, We got booted out of the metro a few stops short of where we were going or intended to go. And we came up at, what was it, Judiciary Square. And when you pop out of the metro at Judiciary Square, you find yourself at the National Law Enforcement Memorial. This is a town of memorials, which is fitting. And this being Memorial Day weekend, the memorials for the and the National Law Enforcement Memorial is, of course, for police officers, law enforcement, public servants who have died in the line of duty. And the memorial was decorated with wreaths and flowers, and it had never dawned on me that we include anyone except the military in Memorial Day. I suppose it's fitting. And so I got to thinking after news broke of the horror out of Santa Barbara that going forward, and probably before now, we should start, maybe start a campaign for building yet another memorial somewhere in Washington, D.C. And perhaps we could call it the Children's Crusade Memorial, or simply the Children's Memorial. I think we now have, or maybe it's not fair just to include children in this. Maybe it needs to be a memorial that includes kids wearing hoodies and carrying a can of iced tea and, well, you know, taste the rainbow, Skittles. Why not? Well, no, not why not. I'm not trying to be flip here. Maybe it needs to be a memorial that includes kids with iced tea and Skittles and hoodies. Maybe it needs to be a memorial that includes a guy texting in a movie theater in Florida. Maybe it needs to be a memorial that includes the names of people simply trying to watch a daggum movie in Aurora, Colorado. Maybe it needs to include the names of people simply gone shopping on a weekend morning in Tucson, Arizona. But yes, most assuredly, let this new memorial include the names of little 6 and 7 year olds chopped into chutney in Newtown, Connecticut, and every other place that people have died of American-style gun violence. Because, you see, every time you say something like, maybe we need to do something about the sickness that is our gun fetish in this country, the National Right Wing Rifle Association will jump up and say, but what about our freedom, and what about when that one in our White House puts his jackbooted heel down on our white, white throats? What about liberty? What about freedom? What about Wolverines? Right? So if firearms possession is by definition some sort of a metric of freedom in this country, and we are only free in this country when everybody's locked and loaded on everybody else in a sort of gunned up version of East Germany, where everybody was informing on everybody else, then by definition, these children, these grown-ups, these teenagers with hoodies and tea and Skittles, they're dying for freedom, aren't they? They kind of have to be, don't they? Because if they're not, well, then they're dying for nothing. But that's not entirely fair either, is it? They're dying for something. They're dying because they're the ones who randomly... Who randomly die in America's blood lottery, sponsored by the NRA and Gun Owners of America. But as we walked today, and our specific purpose today was to go over to Arlington to pay our respects to my uncle and Agnes and our children's great-uncle, who was interred in Arlington last month. I was amazed to see his headstone is already up. And we laid flowers there and then proceeded to walk around the grounds, went up to the Tomb of the Unknown. You know, I never realized until I was looking at the map of Arlington National Cemetery that that was not America's first Tomb of the Unknown. That there was a Tomb of the Unknown Soldier that was consecrated after the Civil War and contains the remains of only Civil War unknown dead. But after the Civil War was over, when it became rather obvious that we weren't going to give up our warlike ways, after the Spanish-American War, after the First World War, well, we needed more room for more unknowns. And so you get the Tomb of the Unknown as it now exists. It is amazing the number, and you get the place is mind-boggling, first and foremost because of the vast acreage of honored dead. To see the final remains of so much bloodshed is harrowing. And of course, historical perspective being something with which I am afflicted, we walked over those grounds in silence. It is a silent place. It is a quiet place. We walked over those grounds, and you can look up and see Robert E. Lee's old place up on the hill. And I just imagined him sitting in his rocking chair, maybe, about 1855, sitting in his rocking chair, rocking in the cool spring breeze of evening, rocking in his rocking chair. Old Marse Robert, rockin', the sun not fully down, and so work not fully done. Old Marse Robert, rockin' in his rockin' chair, watching his Negro slaves toiling away in the soil, in the fields beneath the mount where sat his mansion. Toiling away to create for him the wealth that would maintain that mansion and maintain that plantation. Rockin', rockin', rockin'. listening to hear if they were singing happily, those owned human beings, those violated beings down in the fields. And old Marse just keeps rocking and rocking. And he looks over at Mrs. Lee and says, "My goodness, has the Lord not been good to us, madam?" And she says, "Yes, Robert, yes, he has." And that evening sun goes down. And eventually, the toiling, tormented human beings who create Robert E. Lee's wealth, they go to eat bits and pieces and scraps at the end of the day. And if they're lucky, sleep on a mattress stuffed with straw. If not, simply to sleep on ropes strung between wooden boards. Maybe just sleep on the floor, on the dirt. And get up the next day and do it again. While Mrs. Lee, with her needlework, sits on the porch, rocking and rocking, and feeling absolutely like the favored of the Almighty, rocking and rocking. Yeah. So it seems to me more than fitting that when the war was over, Robert E. Lee was dispossessed of that perch from which his family used to sit and watch its wealth be created. Rocking and rocking. Not so much in the way of rocking chairs down in the slave quarters. Not so much in the way of relaxation. And so while it is seldom mentioned, Arlington National Cemetery, which is hallowed ground for this nation's blessed dead, is also a memorial, or should be, to all those people that old Marse Robert and Mrs. Lee watched down in those fields as they were rocking and rocking. Entire lives were lived out day by day, night by night, in the most vile form of human bondage ever known in the history of humanity. As old Marse Robert and Mrs. Lee sat there, rocking and rocking. People were born on the Lee plantation. They started working as soon as they were able to do something useful next to an older human being in bondage. The harder they worked and the healthy and the better off they stayed, the more fungible, the more valuable they became, while Mr. and Mrs. Lee sat there rocking and rocking. They were born, they grew to adulthood. They had children of their own, never knowing in what instant those children would be ripped from their family and sold off to somebody else who would sit on their front porch, rocking and rocking. So while it is true that Arlington National Cemetery represents bloodshed and anguish, it's worth remembering on this Memorial Day that that ground, from the moment it was inhabited by white aristocrats, has always been a place of anguish and horror and bloodshed. While the white colonial plantation owners sat there in the cool of the evening, rocking and rocking and rocking. So Memorial Day maybe means a little bit more, or maybe I've just got a little broader perspective. Do we have a national holiday? Because I don't think that you can just fit the entirety of the agony of the African slave experience into Martin Luther King's birthday holiday. And thus I ask, do we have another federal holiday that acknowledges the fact that practically everything from the Mason-Dixon line south in this country was built by human beings kept in the midnight agonizing darkness of human bondage? Do we have one of those holidays? No? No? No, because I don't think you can fit it into Labor Day. And you really, really can't shoehorn it into Martin Luther King's birthday. 4th of July? Oh, that'd be a little silly, wouldn't it? No, I don't think there's a holiday. And of course, if you tried to introduce one, there would be all manner of uproar in the Congress as fine, upstanding members of the United States Senate, like Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, and that thing on his head. Well, what about the noble contributions of white people? Oh, you mean the white people who told the black people what to do? And then the black people actually did it? Those white people, Rand? Yeah, I know, I just straw-manned, I'm sorry. But you get accustomed, and seeing as how I probably won't be around here so much after this week, some things are kind of indelible in my brain. We happened to be walking back across from the Capitol South metro station today. Stopped off and, my God, we were parched. Stopped off and had some chips and salsa at a little place called Tortilla Coast. And I think I had about 19 glasses of ice water, which they were very tolerant in providing me. I must have looked like one wore-out old white man. But we heard, you know, you're forever hearing elders or adults trying to explain American history to little children that are being led around D.C. And meanwhile, I kind of crawl into the minds of the little children, and I'm thinking, you know what? I bet they just want to know where the card is of the guy that has the popsicles. But I heard some guy trying to explain why it is that the statue on the top of the dome of the Capitol faces north, and something about so the sun would never set on it. What? That kind of means the sun's always set. But that triggered in my memory why it is that the statue on the top of the Capitol of the United States wears that turkey feather headdress. which is kind of a sort of dressing in red face for the 19th century, back when I guess that was done a lot. It should be remembered that the sculptor who designed that statue originally designed her, what is she, Columbia? Or, I forget. I apologize for not knowing that off the top of my head. But she was originally designed wearing a piece of headgear. That was known at the time as a liberty cap. Or a cap of liberty. They had become quite popular as of 1793 in France among people who had formerly been, you know, the property of the French crown. Peasants. Who, having thrown off the filth that is royalty, and having taken rather dispositive action with regard to said royal house, wore these caps of liberty really as a straight-up symbol that they were now a free people. And thus the statue at the top of the United States Capitol was originally designed wearing a cap of liberty. Well, that wouldn't do. Then, just as now, there had to be committees to approve or disapprove things that were being done. And in this case, a United States senator said that it was eminently improper that a free people such as Americans should have a symbol wearing a cap of liberty, for Americans were already free. Now, for those who have never heard the story before, anyone care to guess? Anyone care to wager the name of the senator who objected to the statue at the top of the Capitol wearing a cap of liberty? Anybody? Bueller? Yeah, it was Jefferson Davis. It was Jefferson Davis who said it ill suited a free people to be represented by someone wearing a cap of liberty. Why? Well, Jefferson Davis was a plantation owner. And he had lots and lots and lots of Negro slaves down home in Mississippi who might very much like to just chop his little old noggin off and wear their own caps of liberty. So that cap of liberty had to go, and instead the sculptor put this sort of hodgepodge amalgam of feathers on top of her head because he could. I don't know why she couldn't have just gone bareheaded. Of course, I got no problem with the cap of liberty either. Teabaggers probably love the cap of liberty now, wouldn't they? I reckon so, don't you? Thank you very much, Don. Got a note on Facebook here a couple of minutes ago from Don. At least I think he's referring to what the discussion is at the moment here. Bob Kincaid, you need to write this down. It is the graduation address I wish I heard. I'm assuming you're talking about the filibuster, Don. If not, please correct me so I'll know better. All weekend long, D.C. was beset by the roars of really, really loud motorcycle engines, because the ride to the wall, of course, is a function of Memorial Day. Sad, sad. Along the way, if you just look at the stones in Arlington, you'll learn, and you're open to it, you'll learn a little bit about American history. I saw a stone whose back was simply had inscribed upon it, "The Rock of the Marne." And I saw the word Marne, and I knew immediately that we were probably talking about the First World War. Never really and I looked it up, and what is that, the 3rd Infantry Division? Who stood their ground back when standing your ground meant something besides shooting an African-American teenager carrying iced tea and Skittles. Jesus, I hate these gun goobers.
I'm going to stand my ground.
No, you stupid pricks. Standing your ground is when the entire French army is running away past you. Because the Germans are hot on their heels. And you decide to stay and fight instead. Because you're the only goddamn thing between the Germans and Paris. And it's 1917. That's standing your ground. When people are dropping dead all around you. Because y'all have decided to be a rock instead of a runner. And I'm not trying to be mean to the French. It's what happened. The 3rd Infantry Division held off the German army at the Marne because the French army had withered. You know, having been in the war since 1914... whereas we were sort of new to it, having just gotten there, you know, Yankee come lately. Oh, we're a prideful bunch. The American Expeditionary Force going into the European theater in World War I, AEF, American Expeditionary Force. Well, little doughboys showing up, marching around, said, "No, no, no. No, this doesn't stand for American Expeditionary Force. By God, this stands for After England Failed." But they would get their baptism of fire. But you just look around here and there, and there's all kinds of little reminders. We walked up one row, actually between rows, and it seemed like every person there had died somewhere between March the 3rd and March the 10th, 1945, in the Pacific Theater. Something bad happened. I've been doing a little research, and I haven't found out what that something bad was, but maybe somebody in the Horn Family Commune congregation can figure it out. But it is a sad place. And I'm kind of glad that I'm up here and, you know, wasn't at home tempted to fire up the smoker and rub down the pork shoulder and rub the barbecue ribs and you know, and treat this as National Grilling Day. Because this is one whopping solemn day. It's a day that began, as it turns out, with the efforts of former slaves to honor their dead piled into a mass unmarked grave down where the treason started in South Carolina. Yeah. And then the little old Southern ladies picked up after that and said, "Well, we can't have them honoring theirs and us not honoring ours." Do you understand? Yeah. it was a worthwhile expedition because it offered an opportunity, a sort of case study or case studies in how much horror has attended the history of this nation from well before its very birth. Sorry, I don't seem to be too light and jolly for this here Moran Monday, but it just hasn't felt jolly at all today. It felt pretty grim. It was a lovely day. The loudest noise that broke the silence at Arlington was when about every minute and a half some great howling commercial aircraft would come screaming overhead, going to a landing at National, which I refuse to refer to by the name that was appended to it by a bunch of godless, soulless, motherless Republicans. It's National Airport. And if they ever get the Silver Line built out to Dulles, which I also find offensively named, I'll do all my flying in and out of there, and never use that putridly named airport, although it's quite convenient. National Airport really is very convenient. You know, it's just bang, bang, metro ride, done. But I feel like I'm participating in some sort of un-American activity by flying in or out of there, considering who it's presently named for. But whether it be the former plantation of old Marse Robert, or whether it be just about any other place in this country that was brutalized by some form of dispossession or bondage, this is the day for taking note of it. Yeah, I mentioned Jefferson Davis and his objections to the cap of liberty. My good, my stars and garters. We cannot have those. I mean, they'll get uppity if they see that. And they'll want their own liberty caps, and then they'll be thinking these human beings. My gracious sakes alive, where's this country going to? I think I'm going to go commit me some treason. I love how the South talks about the honor of the South. When Jefferson Davis himself had sworn an oath to the Constitution of the United States, which he then just peed all over. Honor, please. What honor is there among traitors? What honor is there in treason? But, you know, that's all over with, right? Because, there, you know, you go through the McClellan Gate at Arlington, and there's an inscription that says, here lie 15,000 of the more than 300,000 dead among the Union ranks from the Civil War. That'll kind of stop you in your tracks. Yeah. Here rest 15,585 of 315,555 citizens, not soldiers, citizens, who died in defense of our country from 1861 to 1865. On fame's eternal camping ground, their silent tents are spread, and glory guards with solemn sound the bivouac of the dead. So that was our day. Had a lovely day yesterday. I would be remiss if I did not mention it. It came as a total surprise to me, and it was a delightful surprise, I must add. Paulette Moore, who was the creator of that magnificent documentary piece, To Wisconsin with Love, came to Washington, D.C., specifically in the company of a dear friend of mine from northern Wisconsin, Nick. She came to, because she wasn't the one who did the filming of or the videography of the parts that documentary that I was in. Her students did. She called and said, "We want to come up." And she said, "I want to meet you." And I don't sit around here thinking about I'm somebody anybody wants to meet. But far be it from me to be incivil. And so I said, well, shucks, yeah. And so she and Nick came up. He had taken the train from northern Wisconsin. And we had a little meeting of the minds and a little picnic on the grounds of the Capitol there. And we talked about a lot of things, a lot of the similarities between the struggle for against mountaintop removal in Appalachia, and the struggle for the very essence of the right to continue to live lives in northern Wisconsin. And I mentioned Jefferson Davis a couple of minutes ago. He was kind of on my mind ever since last week. A congressional staffer, in talking to me about the AIC Act, said, well, you know, really, shouldn't an Appalachian senator be the one to introduce that in the Senate? And that's I kind of lost it. I mean, I didn't scream or swear or cuss or spit or foam at the mouth or anything. I said, really? You didn't just say that, did you? You really did. Because that's like suggesting Jefferson Davis should have been the one to introduce the 13th Amendment in Congress, you know, right before he committed treason. Right. But we had the most lovely Sunday afternoon. Ferg was with me, and it seems, and I'm not bragging here except for the fact that I am the typical proud papa, it seems that everyone who meets Ferg for the first time just kind of goes, wow. And he's a little stunned by it too. But I was thrilled to meet Paulette, and it was great to see Nick again. And there are so many commonalities between the two struggles. The one thing going for the folks in northern Wisconsin, they may very well just win this outright on their own terms. Whereas we have the eternal question, and it even attends us with the AIC Act. If we could end mountaintop removal tomorrow, we would have to immediately stop, take stock, and try to understand what is left. Nick looked at me and said, I came through there on the train. And he said, I traveled through the Hunger Games. Yes! That's why in the Hunger Games District 12 in the Hunger Games, where Katniss and Peeta come from, it is Appalachia. That's why I was so amazed the first time we sat down and watched Avatar. You know, the transport space vehicle has landed on Pandora, and the gate comes down in the back and the ramp goes down, and the first thing you see are all these giant yellow earth moving vehicles. And like I said, it was like 2 days after Christmas a few years ago,
and I just kind of elbowed Agnes, and I went, holy shit, it's a mountaintop removal site.
Agnes, in her customary genial way, responded, shh, it's a movie, shut up. Yeah, that time was also delightful for the fact that it was all in 3D, and a little bit later, the children, I mean, it's not like they were tiny, they're just a little bit younger than they are now, but were sort of reaching at the little 3D sparkly things that were floating in front of their faces only weren't. But there are all kinds of metaphors out there for the horrors that are perpetrated against people simply trying to live their lives. And I do not for an instant think that mountaintop removal is the only or the worst. But for me, it's near enough and awful enough. And my personal feeling is that if I can't get... I get worked up about it because we live with it. But I don't live in northern Wisconsin, and I am absolutely gutted by just how ugly the plans up there are. To destroy 20 miles of hills, a half mile wide and 1,400 feet deep. Yeah, but when we're done, we're going to leave you a lake to go feminine. It's not a mile from Lake Superior. Like, Lake Superior's not good enough? What, you can do better than Lake Superior? Pukes. The horrors of fracking. The abject, disgusting prospect of the completion of all of the Keystone XL pipeline. The notion, and you all know my relationship with Northwest Alabama, the notion, and you've all seen pictures of Alberta, right? The tar sands? Which, if you're going to Canada, you have to refer to as oil sands, or they'll take you over and cavity search your ass. Literally. The idea of turning Northwest Alabama into Alberta's tar sands? Oh, my God. And I don't have any problem generating outrage over any of that. Whew. It's all around us. And it's all around us in the form of a concept of extreme desperation. These money grubbers, these capitalists on bad acid are going for the very last that this planet has to dig, gouge, scrape, rip, tear out of it. And they expect us to be silent. Yeah, we're going to bring you some jobs. Oh, you got some jobs? Oh, really? Really, my kid can be a bologna slicer at the Rippy Mart? If only you can blow up the entire region? Well, damn, that's a great bargain. Can I push the first plunger? Yeah, I know people, I've been getting some turn up the volumes, but if I turn up the volumes, the volume, the next time that I crank up the music, I'm going to get another note saying, oh my God, the music is so much louder than the voice. There are some limitations of working here. I don't have nearly the fine control over the audio that I do back in the home studio where... Well, I've got fine control to the extent that the board's kind of dying. Anyway, a note coming in from Bill in Helena, Montana. Hey, Bob. Haven't been able to... And by the way, let me know if I'm getting all distorted or anything, because you got people out there who've cranked their players up to 11. Oh, okay. Part of that volunteer staff aspect, Sparky's keeping me apprised. Volume's fine, Bob. Okay, thank you. On TuneIn on the Kindle. Okay, great, thank you. That really does help a lot, because I don't like to just crank the outputs. No, note coming in from Bill in Helena, Montana. And he says, hey, Bob. Hey, Bill. Haven't been able to catch all the broadcasts from this D.C. trip, so my apologies if this has already been covered. Have you and Ferg been to the Vietnam Wall? That was my generation's sad contribution to the City of Monuments. I graduated from high school in 67, just in time for the Summer of Love, but was a prisoner of war during the Sexual Revolution. Jesus, how do you even write a sentence like that? I did. Joined the Navy in 69 and stayed till 75. Didn't get to see the wall until the early 90s. It is a terrible tribute to the lies, hubris, and corruption that we are all too familiar with. 58,000 human lives, the large majority of which I assume were very close to Ferg's age right now. If you get an opportunity to see it, I look forward to the customarily eloquent filibuster on the subject. Thank you, Bill. It was, oh my, maybe 6 years ago that we went. Maybe Ferg was 12. I think it's time we went back. I think Ferg was troubled by the whole Arlington experience. Because going to Arlington should be a bit troubling. It really should be. On this day, there were little Cub Scouts in their blue and Boy Scouts in their khakis and all over giving out free roses and all kinds of other free flowers to go and place on the graves. Which is well and honorable and appropriate. But if you get away from there without having contemplated, without having ruminated upon the horror of human conflict, of war, then you kind of missed the point of the whole endeavor. Or so say I. Because that is, it's acres upon acres, hectares, of just crushing grief. And so too it is with the Vietnam Wall. So many of these memorials in Washington, D.C. are memorials that are memento mori. We try to remember things because we acknowledge the sacrifice involved, but we also acknowledge the tremendous gobs of human anguish and agony and pain, not just for the people who were killed, but for the ones who survived, for the loved one who got the visit, the knock on the door. My father used to tell me about when they came, and of course he wasn't at home. He was aboard ship. But later on he learned what it was like when the knock came at the door in Anstead, West Virginia. He knew in his own right, because everybody aboard ship knew that if you got the visit from the chaplain, something, because nobody wants much to do with chaplains. And if the chaplain comes to see you, something god-awful has happened that isn't necessarily to you. And my father said that when the chaplain sent for him and he came up out of the boiler room. You know what he, you know what he was sure had happened? He was absolutely certain that he was going to go to the chaplain's office and be told that his daddy had been killed in some mine explosion or in a slate fall. Because, see, even as the Second World War progressed, you had a better chance of being killed by some American capitalist in a coal mine than you did by a Nazi or a member of the Wehrmacht or a member of the Imperial Army, Air Force, or Navy of Japan. Right. So all these things have come to mind on this Memorial Day. It's about 4 minutes before the hour. A reminder, and thanks very much to our good friend Psychoticus Rex, we now have a means by which people who have just regular old telephones just can reach the program. It's no longer just Skype to Skype. We can receive a straight-up telephone call here now, which I hope will significantly enhance the concept of conversation radio. That number, of course, is 304-574-8178. Write it down. Please make a note of it. 304-574-8178. It spells nothing. 304-574-8178. But if you are limited to or not good with Skype or the phone is what you choose to use, that's how you reach the program. Of course, if you wish to connect via Skype, that's easy too. Skype to Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn, Bob Kincaid Horn. And Psychoticus is even working on further enhancements that will eventually allow us to be doing toll-free stuff again, which is really cool. So we'll take a little break. A reminder, Paul, otherwise known as Paul from Fremont or Paulie in the Malloy chat room, is entirely responsible for taking care of fundraising for this evening's program. If you would like to stand alongside Paulie, you are welcome to do so and maybe help get us a little bit out front as we run downhill toward the end of the month of May. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. So, too, is the traditional mail address, that mail address being The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB, personal mailbox, 318 Beckley, BECKLEY, WV25801. Remember, when you're using the mails, checks and money orders should not be made payable to Bob Kincaid, but should, in fact, be made payable to The Horn, Head on Communications, something like that. Because it makes things ever so much easier. So for now, we're going to take a little break, come back to your calls. This is Conversation Radio. I cannot emphasize enough that it is listener-supported. This, indeed, is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Halls where justice did once reside. has been sold out and replaced with lies. It's all money, power to the few. How long until they come for you? And he said that it can never happen here. And he said it can never happen here. Burn habeas corpus, tear up the writs, rubber stamp Senate of hypocrites. Those new detention camps weren't built for show. Posse comitatus is next to go. And he said it can never happen here. And he said that it can never happen here. Fear rules a mob. You print the truth, you lose your job. The cream will mix it safe for you. It's death for many, riches for the few. And you say that it can never happen here. And you say
that I'd like This is the pillow where he used to lay his head. Some old books I would read to him in bed. Here's a trophy from when he played Little League ball. Here's another day I spend staring at the wall. I keep a room of his things, but he's never coming back. Please tell me, why did my son die in Iraq? I need the truth from you, not from one of your paid hacks. Please tell me, why did my son die in Iraq?
Well, if that's not appropriate to Memorial Day, I don't know what is. The inestimable John Kuntz, It Can Never Happen Here, and the ballad, Iraq. 7 minutes past the hour, and we will forthwith have a go at finding out whether or not the phone system actually works. Now, it's different from the phone system when we're working out of the studio back in almost level West by God, Virginia, because you can't get to hold audio. Okay, there's the answer to the deaths that we found. Hey, Ferg, you know all those gravestones we saw that were marked March 1945?
Yeah.
Iwo Jima. Yeah. And we have Jethro to thank for that. Thank you, Jethro. It went from February to March 1945. And it should be remembered that Ira Hayes, who was portrayed as having died because he was a Native American and they can't handle their liquor, that no, Ira Hayes died from, Jethro tells me, not from alcohol, but from war trauma. Let's find out if the phone system works. I suspect this might be Bill. Is it Bill?
Yeah.
Hey, Bill, how are you? Long time no talk.
Well,
to.
I'm sorry about the.
Sorry about the busted phone system. Yeah, sorry about the busted phone system.
Hey, it's the way it goes. I don't know, that Skype stuff is, I've talked to my computer, my ace computer repairman, you would know who it is.
Absolutely.
Actually, I've got two of them that I've met through the horn that can do everything but reach through the back of the thing and make it work better. Yeah, I didn't know it was Hero, huh?
What?
So I heard you mention Ira Hayes, so...
Yeah, it was war trauma. It was war trauma, not alcohol.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking of the battle you were talking about. It had to be. I knew it was either Okinawa or Iwo, and I didn't.
I didn't place Iwo with February, March, 1945. But I did mention to Ferg as we were wondering what it was. I said, well, that's about the time things started to get really, really nasty, as we prepared for the invasion of the home islands.
Yeah, they well, they Eagle was going to be a good place, another good place for the planes to drop fire and smoke on the people. I mean, we well, a buddy of mine's father flew for Curtis LeMay during the war, so. You know, it's the old story. If you're around long enough, you'll meet somebody that had some connection to it. And of course, the other one, Okinawa, you know who the commander was there?
No.
Simon Bolivar Buckner, the second guy to use that name. The first one surrendered Fort Donelson to Grant.
But
on the other hand, he was, I think he was one of Grant's wedding party members, because that old army, that civil pre-Civil War army, was like a big fraternity, you know?
Yeah.
I'll tell you what really got me, I was thinking about the other night, was Dan Sickles. Sickles was a congressman, and Sickles had a very attractive wife. And Mrs. Sickles had a friendly relationship with Philip Barton Key. Now, think of the Latin name, right?
Right.
His father had something to do with a song that he makes us stand up in front of in
yeah, exactly.
a baseball game.
Yeah, and died. In, the son died in a duel, right?
Yeah. Well, his son died. The story was that Dan Sickles chased him across the street and after a fight shot him. Because Sickles had to go up in front of a judge. And for a judge, for an attorney, he got Lincoln's Secretary of War, Stanton.
Yeah.
And the defense, supposedly for the first time was in use in this country, was temporary insanity.
Oh, that's right. That's right. And, of course, Sickles was involved in a controversial...
Gettysburg, yeah.
Gettysburg, right. Yeah, you know, Ferg and I went walkabout in downtown D.C. this past Saturday. And if you just happen to be paying attention to what you're walking past, because everything seems to be a store or a shop or something, but they have kindly provided these little markers that'll tell you that they used to be something else. And so we walked past, for instance, it's a big federal building now. I'm not sure which big federal building it is, but we walked past a big federal building. And it had a plaque affixed, to its wall, Bill. And I'm looking for it. Here it is. And the plaque said, Samuel F. B. Morse. Because I'll bet you don't know this. Samuel F. B. Morse.
He's a wire man, yeah.
Yeah, hold on, though, because there's some Paul Harvey, the rest of the story involved with this. Samuel F. B. Morse, artist and inventor, opened and operated on this site under the direction of the Post Office Department, the first public telegraph office in the United States, April 1st, 1845, and underneath is, in quotes, "What hath God wrought?"
Wrought. Yeah.
Now, very few people, except those who listen to the horn and are part of our little horn family commune congregation, know that that was just one line of a two-line exchange. Because "what hath God wrought" gets sent, and what is returned is, "And how is Mrs. Royal this morning?" Do you have any idea who Mrs. Royal was?
Well, no, I don't. But...
Well, Mrs. Royal was Anne Royal. And she led what can only be described as a difficult and colorful life. She was the widow of a landholder and veteran who settled in Greenbrier County of what was then Virginia, is now West Virginia.
West Virginia, yeah.
And she got cheated out of her legacy in his will by some mean-spirited children because she married him late in life. She was poor. He fell in love. And basically they argued, well, you know, she used her evil feminine wiles to do him out of his.
Oh, of course, yeah. Yeah,
right. I mean, we've been there, right? It's not like that isn't happening
today.
I love
that. I had a lot of women do that to me when I was a musician. They used the evil feminine wiles on me.
So in a desperate attempt to remain alive, and because it turned out that she was a brilliant human being, she reinvented herself. And she became, long before Mark Twain ever boarded the boat for the Levant and Palestine that would later turn into the Innocents Abroad, she did travel writing. And she traveled as far down into Alabama and wrote about what she saw there and became an instantaneous sensation. Later on, she would come back to Washington, D.C. and buy her own printing press. And she published, and I got all of this from our good friend Jeff Biggers, by the way. It's all in his book, The United States of Appalachia. But she published her own scandal sheet. It was called Paul Pry. And she was, you know, 1845, thereabouts, this country is in the grips of a dose of Christian religious fundamentalism that makes the current one seem almost tame.
What was the name for that, Bob? There was a name.
That was the Second Great Awakening.
Yes.
And so she saw these Christians for the flim-flam artists that they were, and she began publishing against them. You could almost say that Ann Royal, with her publication Paul Pry, that she was she was America's, maybe the world's, first blogger.
Yep.
And she got so far under the skin of these evangelical fundamentalist riffraff that men of the cloth, pastors of the Prince of Peace, assaulted her, threw her down the stairs from her apartment, and smashed her printing press in an attempt to silence her. But that's not the connection with Samuel F. B. Morse. She saw the potential of the telegraph when she first heard about it. And she began to raise, and in, you know, 1840-ish America, there's no idea of the power of debt to be creatively used to let government do big things. Okay? And so it was kind of a libertarian, I guess you could say it was sort of a libertarian paradise. As well as being a human bondage paradise for the southern planters.
Those words seem to go that, you know, that well together, paradise and, yeah.
Right. Exactly. So she gets on the bandwagon of the newfangled telegraph, and Congress, in the meantime, is saying, this doesn't look like anything we want to spend our money on. Harumph, harumph, harumph. We've got graft and corruption to support here. Harumph.
Yep.
And so she wore them out, and at the same time, I think it was either John Quincy Adams or Martin Van Buren, and I can't remember whom, but it was one of those mid-century presidents who we forget very easily, who had the habit of taking his morning constitutional down to the shores of the Potomac, where he would bathe naked of a morning. It was a young country. And so she found out about this, went down one morning after he'd gone skinny dipping into the river. And back then it wasn't toxic to even get wet in the Potomac like it is now. And as soon as he was in up to his neck, she walked out of the bushes with his clothing in hand and said, if you care to do anything short of walking back to the White House as naked as the day you were born, you will support Mr. Samuel F. B. Morse and his newfangled telegraph device. Which he then agreed to do. And being a man of honor and a man of his word, he did. And so it was that when they did the first official test of the newfangled telegraph device, the one message goes out, "What hath God wrought?" And the message returns, "How is Mrs. Royal this morning?" Because she was almost single-handedly responsible for the support that the Telegraph received. She may as well have been God.
That was, we talk about an effective difference in the American Civil War and the other ones before it, Telegraph. These guys, I used to know the name of the guy that used to answer the, with you running the Telegraph in Washington, because the one thing about President Lincoln, he liked to know what was going on. And the
Oh, Lincoln would sit in the Telegraph office.
Yeah. Well, the killing of Philip Barton Key took a place that you've probably been at, Lafayette Square.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, all these squares, everybody's got one named after them. Bob, did they get you yet?
No, I haven't. I haven't rated one. But you know, well, after the Civil War, after the Civil War, there's
the public square, but that's a different thing.
Yeah. And I was going to tell you something else while we were walkabout on Saturday. Just the stuff you'll find. We found a place that is preserved as a museum in the midst of a bunch of commerce that turned out to be Clara Barton's office. Nobody knows about this aspect of her life. It's always Clara Barton, the mother of the American Red Cross, blah, 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 blah. Well, for 5 years after the close of the Civil War, Bill, it turns out that Clara Barton ran an outfit which endeavored with no other purpose to locate missing soldiers for those soldiers' families so they could either find out that the person was alive or more likely dead, but to provide closure. And she kept that office open, and it sits there on 7th. She kept that office open for 5 years. And then we turned the block. And we saw the corner of 6th and E. And, of course, any corner has, any intersection has four corners under most circumstances. And 6th and E is rather famously about a mile from the White House. And 6th and E is where that humorless man, Salmon P. Chase.
Oh, yes. Beautiful dog. Okay,
yeah. First rented and then bought a brick house, which his magnificent, beautiful daughter Kate then decorated and presided over. It no longer stands, and more's the pity. But he, Salmon P. Chase, came to bitterly regret taking up residence there, because in the meanwhile. William H. Seward had taken up residence at a house that was just catty-cornered to the White House. And so Seward had constant access to the president, where Chase, who was also an egomaniac, by the way, where Chase had limited access because he was so damned far away at a mile from the White House.
Well, I wanted to get my hands on a book that I read while my eyes were still working, Lincoln's Cabinet. It was written by a fine female historian.
Doris Kearns Goodwin?
Pardon me?
Doris Kearns Goodwin?
Yeah. Because, you know, the thing about that stuff is, Bob, but you start going over the history of Washington, D.C., the names change, but the motives and profit margin doesn't seem to change that much. Because of all the corruption in, that's what Truman made his name, sitting on the thing in Congress when he was a senator, fighting against corruption that was being laid all over our, you know, military acquisitions. In fact, Truman actually had a few good things to say about some of the Republicans that were on the panel that helped slap some of their own people in jail for the corruption they were running.
Yeah.
And, of course, we saw, what did we see in the beginning of the Iraq mess, when the helmets were, the Marines seemed to have better helmets than the Army did as far as bouncing it off the ceiling of an armored vehicle? Bob, you keep asking yourself, does any of this crap ever change? Or do they just find new ways? And Simon Cameron, I don't have to say anything about him, do I?
No. You mean the uniforms that fell off when wet? Fell apart when wet? Well, I think given the limitations that you have to deal with, Bill, I think the stuff is out there. You should be able to get a voiced copy of the works of Mark Twain.
Oh, yeah. That my dad bought me a hardbound copy of that when I was a kid, and I got into some of it. Of course, if you didn't read Huck Finn or Tom Sawyer, you weren't living, I think.
Well, that's not where I'm going in this case. No. He wrote lots of short stories.
Oh, yeah.
And by the time that the Civil War was over, most people were caught up in the actual day-to-day horrors of the war, but by the same token, there had been volumes of stories to roll out of the federal government about the corruption in the procurement process. And as only Mark Twain could do, and he briefly visited Washington, D.C., and essentially ran screaming from it, as only Mark Twain could do, he took the story away. He sort of distilled the idea of government procurement contracts, and he concentrated it into one tale. And if you can ever find it, one, you won't stop laughing for the next week. But two, you'll as is always the case with Twain, you'll pick up the underlying reality. And the name of the short story is The Facts in the Great Beef Contract. And it concerns an attempt on the part of a defense contractor, what we would recognize as a defense contractor now, to simply get paid. And it is a hilarious romp. And of course, internally, it's the story of the next generation or one guy failing and another guy picking up the torch of continuing to try to get paid. And it's absolutely brilliant. And well worth the look-see.
They just keep tying into each other, Bob. They just keep tying in and tying in. There's a lot of people who think that the Battleship Maine, the explosion of the Battleship Maine, was a little dicey.
And one of the first, we went looking for among the oldest of the old graves, and eventually Ferg found one today from the Spanish-American War, which, of course, launched me off into an explosion. Up until Vietnam came along, we really didn't have a good example. Well, kind of World War One too, but it was made illegal in this country to criticize World War One. So, but the Spanish-American War was our best example post-Civil War of just abject stupidity in warfare.
Yeah, well, we went over there to the Philippines, and it was really a sad case. With Aconaldo and company versus the United States.
Well, and again you get Mark Twain, who writes the War Prayer as a result of learning of the American atrocities in the Philippines. And his longtime editor said, "Damn, Sam, you can't publish this. You're a national icon. You're a beloved of the nation, and your name will be mud the minute this thing hits print." So the War Prayer doesn't get published until after Twain is dead. And I remember reading it on air during the Iraq War, and oh my God, that was back when I still had to deal with little right wing horses' asses. And I remember, Bill, all the little hopping up and down the loyal Bushies, and Jethro's in the chat room, and I'll bet you Jethro's gone. Damn it. But I know Jethro remembers having to deal with it, because they didn't like me reading that stuff about the great patriotic war that the great Christian Bush was initiating against those demons from Iraq.
Bob, that reminds me of a line that got me in trouble with Professor Bill Randall one time, and I said that the BS degree is self-explanatory. MS, more of the same. And, of course, PhD just meant piled higher and deeper. I don't know if you ever heard that one or not.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Carl, that's how things are handled. But, you know, you've mentioned the name Paul Pry. In his book, The Short History of the Civil War by Fletcher Perez, he described Pinkerton's people as Paul Pry's. And I often wonder where the hell he got that from. I mean, it makes sense to me because of the, when you say Pry, you're getting some kind of detective work going here somewhere.
Well, Paul Pry was originally the scandal sheet published by Ann Royal.
I'll be darned. Because, I have never heard of her. I think I've heard of most everything at least once. Yeah, the Rock of the Mar, and I wasn't sure whether that was the third or the second.
It was the third, and they were led by an officer with the unfortunate name of Dick Man.
Oh, yeah.
D-I-C-K-M-A-N.
He is serious.
Yeah.
But he would not let his troops flee when all, well, you know, it was one of those Rudyard Kipling moments. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs.
Well, yeah, we know that you hit it right about the French army. I mean, they lost so many people in there, the one campaign of 1917. That's when some of those guys just refused to go forward, which led us to a movie that you might have seen called Paths of Glory.
Mm-hmm.
Where the French were taking men out and executing them for refusing to go over the top, so to speak. And the British in Belgium at that year, they lost a 500,000 people in casualties from about 4 miles of territory.
Yeah, if that...
That war we reached it all, that was the infantrymen's, and of course, then they followed it up with a disease that most Americans never heard of. Maybe my family was at the right age. The Spanish influenza was a son of a bitch. It wiped them out, heavy. It's just, there's so many things that happen, and that's what bothers me about people who tell me that history is boring. They haven't dug very hard, have they?
Well, no, they haven't, but let's be fair, Bill. Somewhere along the way, some teacher of only marginal competence ruined history for them.
Yeah.
I mean, I happen to have a teacher who ruined mathematics for me, because I have a limited ability therein, and couple that with a really bad teacher, and the next thing you're going, no more of that, please. Had enough. But
my high school record is an abomination until I took the high school equivalency test and finished in the upper 10% in reading and comprehension. And that, those two things, Bob, they open a door for you. Because like my one buddy who's a professional mechanic, he said, Bill, if you couldn't figure it out looking at it, you'd read about it and you'd find out what the problem was and you'd go after it,
Yeah.
Because that was the key, is to know. I don't give a damn what you're doing. If you don't have the foggiest idea of how to do it, you can make a fool. The only thing the average person can do without any prior training is bend the elbow. That comes easy. I saw enough of that crap, too.
Yeah, no kidding.
Every day. When I went to work, I can't tell you. One night, I went in to fix something on a Saturday after playing Friday, and the woman says, you did a half a fifth last night in the gym. I said, oh, really? But you mentioned the Paul Pry thing. Pratt used that to describe the Pinkertons. I mean, that whole war was so ungodly different. I don't think the Gatling gun ever saw any actual service in any major battle.
It was used out west, was it not?
Yeah, maybe later on against the Indians. I don't know.
Yeah. Because as brutal and inhuman as warfare is, it was, you know, that was deemed just to be a little too nasty to be using on other white people.
I guess so. There was a guy, what was his name? Not Ripley or whoever was chief of ordnance for the Union Army. He didn't like him. And so he, you know, they had everything else. They were repeating carbine and, you know, that 58 caliber bullet was the utmost. If it hit you in the arm.
Well, for people, for people with a functioning understanding of what caliber of bullet means. Yeah. 58 caliber. God damn, that's practically a marble.
Yeah, it was good size. And the other thing that was really useful was the field artillery, the 12 pounder especially, the close up stuff. Shooting canister. Imagine a canister full of oversized balls. And how they double shot the thing. And how many times have I read where the damn a line of gun to fire and canister just shut stuff down immediately? It's always horrible. Those men were unbelievable. I mean, every generation, they're unbelievable, that's for damn sure. Because your uncle and your dad were both fighters?
No, just my uncle. My dad was just a water tender third class in the belly of an aircraft carrier. Just.
Still not what you call a great job either. Because, you know, when those things started, at Franklin, that's a story and a half of that.
Well, the USS, my uncle flew off the Franklin. Until it kind of got, you know, beaten all the hell out from under him.
Yeah, you know, the Japanese, when I read the thing a couple of years ago by Max Hastings, that the Japanese were preparing a load of anthrax to take down to the big island, Saipan. And the boat sank. Maybe they sunk it on purpose. I hope. I mean, they hope that the submarines got it. They were going to dump anthrax on the U.S. So I have a hard time. You know, the thing is, I don't give a crap what it is. People go to war. They'll unleash. My one buddy, whose father was a German sub-officer, we talked about it, and he always said, you know, the trouble with the Germans is they were... You see, you talk about guys who had to keep accurate records of everything—damn Teutonic bookkeepers, you know.
Yeah. Of course, where Memorial Day is concerned, Bill, I got a note from our buddy, my grass mowing buddy Dennis in Kentucky. You know, he listens to the podcast while he mows the yard, so I say we mow the lawn together. He does all the work; I just do the talking. But he sent me a graphic earlier today that said it was a picture of a military cemetery, and it said Memorial Day, honor their deaths by questioning anyone, calling for more of them.
Well, yeah. Who was Blackjack Logan, who was one of Sherman's, and out west he had been a corps commander and division commander. He's the one who was in charge of starting Decoration Day, as they called it then. He was head of the GAR, which, you know, Grand Army of the Republic, which was, you know, an early, you know, veterans groups are always popular regardless of whatever the war is. If you survive it, you get together with the other guys. I know Confederate Memorial Day was different, wasn't it, Bob? They had a couple of them, some of the states, too. They had two different days among the southern states as a Memorial Day.
Robert Bateman over, Lieutenant Colonel Robert Bateman, over at the Esquire.com politics blog that's managed and very well written by Charlie Pierce. Robert Bateman writes military history, Civil War stuff over there, but he also wrote a history of Memorial Day that was brilliantly done. And published it last week, and talked about the origins on both sides of Memorial Day, and you know, explained it as an attempt on both sides simply to gather together with veterans who could actually understand what they were talking about when you're trying to explain what it's like to have, you know, to just have, you know, 1,000 people mowed down in a couple of minutes. Because when you go, you know, there were no fancy the scientific terms back then, like post-traumatic stress disorder. I'd never heard this until I read Colonel Bateman's column. After the Civil War, men who had come back and were deeply traumatized were referred to as having soldier's heart.
Yeah. No, it's a good reference point as far as, you know, their whole feelings were. In fact, there's recordings, there's written recordings of some of Sherman's speeches. You know, Sherman was not a nice guy in warfare.
No.
But in later years, when he was talking to his survivors, and they had their kids with him, he came out and was pretty much anti-war. When he told the truth about it, he didn't overdress it.
Well, wasn't it old Marse Robert, Bill, who said, it is good that war is so awful, lest we should love it too much?
Too much, yeah.
Sick old bastard.
I had a real high opinion of him as a kid, but, well, I don't know. Well, there's been things written about him that don't point to the fact that he was not going as much with the flow as, you know, as things were changing, you know?
See, we're fed that line about how Robert Lee, I have to choose my state. Bull.
That never hit me with any degree of anything anyway. I mean, maybe because I was still listening to guys who came back from Europe and the Pacific. I heard a lot of those guys talk.
Well, but really, I mean,
so
this man has sworn an oath to the Constitution, and the Constitution contains a clear and unambiguous definition of treason, and this guy says, I'll have to serve Old Virginia. Bullshit.
Right. The man
was crassly trying to protect his wealth.
And his wealth was, I don't think it was actually wealth that he had generated.
Oh, no, but it was wealth that became self-generating because like other Southern planters, the vast majority of his wealth was held in human bondage.
Yeah, because Arlington, you know, being his family, because Lee was, all those guys were spread from here to hell, Bob. I mean, 15,500 men regulars, and Joe Hooker, that's another thing. Joe Hooker was on the West Coast, and people said he became almost a beach cobra in the years.
I mean, if you
know where that word came from now.
Oh, sure. But if you want to crawl around inside the mind of a traitor, like Lee, well, specifically Lee, you have to start with the fact that as an oath-taking sworn defender of the Constitution as a member of the United States Military Officer Corps, he did not have any problem whatsoever presiding over the hanging of John Brown. Okay? Let's just work with that for a minute. He was more than happy to hang a man who had taken up arms against the government of the United States, hello, treason,
yeah,
in order to see people held in bondage freed, and in the process had attacked the armory at Harper's Ferry, Virginia. Robert E. Lee had no problem killing that man in the name of the state of Virginia.
Funny you should mention Harper's Ferry. I just bought a book out of the store called The Glint of Bayonets, which is a study of Antietam, because I've read that battle is so constant. You know, the Lee's lost order, all these crazy things that happened. were just nuts.
But in that moment at Harper's Ferry, where old Mars Lee orders somebody to swing the trap.
Yep.
He realizes what's coming in the wind. Because it wasn't just John Brown. There was a vociferous campaign against slavery in the North, and Robert Lee's wealth was primarily concentrated in slaves. And so he creates this fiction of standing with Virginia, when in fact he was standing with my money.
Well, Bob, who made the movement in the slave rebellion in Virginia that was very small, but it's still...
Nat Turner?
Nat Turner, yes. Because when I learned about that, I said, I never knew that happened. They never taught me that in high school history class. What? They didn't talk about that. I mean, after all, you know. Because the whole thing was, it was such a destructive situation that, and old Abe, he bind up the wounds of the country. Yeah, somebody goes and shoots him. It's like, when does this all stop? You know, does it ever stop? His assassination could be primary, but you have to think of something else too, and I can't think of what. The 2nd U.S. Cavalry Regiment was started by Jefferson Davis, who had been, of course, Secretary of War. And he's also the guy that brought the camels into the Southwest. And I don't mean the ones you smoke.
Yeah.
He tried to use them in the Southwest desert after studying a little bit about their use in North Africa, in the sands, you know. Yeah, but he started the 2nd Regiment, and the leader was Albert Sidney Johnston, CSA, killed at Shiloh.
Yep.
Lee was part of the staff. I think he was the 2nd in command. And Hardee, who was a corps commander and small army commander for the South. The only guy that got lumped in there was George Thomas. And, of course, he was from Virginia, too, so evidently Davis was kind of geographically oriented, you see. When you read these histories of these wars and you learn about the personalities and the backgrounds of, another name that came out of there. You know those big bushy things that come down the side of your face like the kind
yeah,
of...
Burnsides. Like Burnsides, sideburns, exactly.
Yeah, it was amazing. I can remember, I'll leave you with this. I was standing on the Confederate side of where Burnside Bridge is. And it's a beautiful day, and I hear all this laughter. And I'm thinking, what's going on? All this laughter on this field, you know? And there was a bunch of kids in canoes going down Antietam Creek. And I'm still trying to figure out what the route was that goes from Harper's to direct to Sharpsburg. And you mentioned a place on one side of the Potomac, and the name, I think, they have auto racing there. It's a big track. Across the Potomac, Maryland to the other side, Mechanics.
Mechanicsville?
Yeah. I thought there was a track there. I'm not sure. You can't keep... One thing about the Anglo-Saxons is we use the same names over and over, and you can't figure out where the hell you are. But that 20-minute ride from Harper's to Sharpsburg, and just the confluence of the Shenandoah and the Potomac, it's just, I can't describe it, Bob. I can't. And that little area where you come up to go there, there's a big mountain, South Mountain? Maryland Heights, it's called, Maryland Heights. And those houses are so close to the street that me, with my evil mind, I thought, if I had a stick, I could goose these guys leaning on their cars in there, you know? I mean, that's how close it is to the street. And, of course, the Kennedy Farm, which is on the way between, and that's where Brown hung out. Brown was hanging out at this Kennedy Farm. I mean, Bob, I could never learn enough about the, I think the utmost that got me was the bloody angle of Spotsylvania. Stand there and knowing what happened there. It's, well, at Gettysburg, the first time I went there, I was just turned 17, I think, and I was down at Spangler Spring, which was turned off for the winter. This was February, and I was there. But I got overcome with something that scared the living crap out of me, and I ran. Of course, at 17, I can still run pretty good. But now if I started running, who's that guy laying there? You know? But that got me once, and on the first day's field, by a place called Barlow's Knoll. That I said to my first wife was with me, I said, feel my arm. It's a hot day, Bob. She says, your arm is cold and clammy. I said, yeah. Sometimes stuff happens and you can't explain it and you don't want to, so the hell with it. There are times, and because I have this funny feeling about them. I know people are used to picnic in cemeteries and such, and I didn't know about that. Maybe the smell is too much or something. There's something bothers me. Anyway, I'll let you go. Thank God you got a phone again, because I've got to get one of my advisors down here and get my email straightened out again. I can receive it, but I'm real bad at sending it because I don't even have your email address.
Oh, golly.
In fact, if you... Pardon me?
I said, oh, golly.
Yeah, I had it, but let me see if I can get something to write with. This is a pain in the ass when your eyes are bad, Bob. You can't... Luckily... Well, I'll be a little crass and say, thank God they make zippers so you don't lose everything. You still can find certain items if you need to use them. Okay, let me have your it's.
Yeah, it's just Bob Kincaid, BOBKINCAID, Bob Kincaid.
KINCAID. KID, yeah, common good
no,
old
no,
common
no, 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 KINCAID.
CAID.
Yeah.
Okay, at...
Gmail.com.
Gmail?
Yeah, gmail.com.
Yeah. Because, as I say, I'm fighting with this... as I said, this computer of mine is... Sometimes I think it does better at throwing smoke signals than it does emails anymore. And this is a 15-year-old... what was the one you got rid of? The type that we all love so much?
Which?
Yeah, which program? What was the model name on that thing? You just lost one of these not long ago, a year ago or so.
I think maybe you dropped out a little bit. Say it again.
The computer operating system.
XP. Yeah.
XP. And if I'm not mistaken, that seems to be one that people really liked.
Well, they did, but 7 is quite functional and quite good and almost as easy to get around. And at some point in time, somebody's going to have to get you hooked up with 7. Because
one buddy that's working so hard with me on the other stuff, this CD he had made by a bunch of Cleveland bands, including myself, and I'm behind myself. But he's done a lot for me, but I think we're starting to run out of patience with each other. That's part of the problem. You can only put up with some people for so long, and then all of a sudden it's like, I'd like to smack that fat old man. Anyway, you take care of yourself.
Well, thanks, Bill. It's awful. It's awful.
Thanks to the guy who got the phone working.
Oh, it's not got it working. It's a workaround. You may not realize, you and I are on Skype right now.
Oh, it's a tie-in to Skype.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I've been told that that's not really that easy for me to work with, although somebody said, well, how about microphones? I said, I never saw one in my life. No, come on.
There's microphones and there's microphones, Bill.
Yeah. Well, that's a headset mic is what it amounts to. That's all it is. Hell, I don't even know where you plug the damn thing in at, you know? Or
right.
If my computer would even take it.
Well, there's a headset now.
there's a headset now, Bill, that is in broad use among the Horn Molloy Skype chat group that's a real dandy. And it's it just plugs into the, I guess it just plugs into the USB port of your computer. But this'll work, you know, for as long as need be, this'll work just fine.
Yeah. Well, I hope so. Because I do miss, I hope I didn't bore people to death tonight, but I think we hit some pretty strong points about the fact that the thing about the world is the more it, my dad used to have a saying, the more it changes, the more it seems to stay the same. The basic human, all the technology and all the stuff changes. Human nature.
Yeah.
And human behavior. How much does it change?
Very little.
You boil it down to the lowest common denominator of behavior.
You know what? A dead soldier of Hammurabi, a dead soldier of Pharaoh, a dead Roman legionnaire, a dead Pomeranian grenadier, a dead member of His Majesty's Army, and a dead American soldier 3 days in the heat.
Yep.
Not a lot of difference.
Yeah, they kind of are the same.
It little matters whether it was grape shot, small arms fire, or artillery. Dead is dead is dead.
Did you see, you've seen the movie that was made from the book Killer Angels?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, my second wife always wanted to know why I didn't become a reenactor. I said, first of all, I work weekends. Secondly, I'll be damned if I'm going to go out and spend $500 on a badly fitting wool suit and walk around with it. Because I did my share of playing guns when I was a kid. So we did that as a matter of growing up. Christ almighty, Bob, my toy collection looked like a freaking armory. Well, there was one that my grandmother bought me. It was modeled on the Thompson of the type used by the fellas running the booze. You know, it had a drum on it.
Yeah.
And when you pull the trigger, you wound it up and pull the trigger, it had a flint in it. So it sparked real nice. Don't tell me that people weren't playing with their head even then about stuff. As I say, that my old man made him, he was not all right on everything, but the more things change, the more they stay the same. Oh, there was another book I'll recommend quick. It was a piece of science fiction about a bunch of guys with foreign accents and badly fitting suits that show up at Lee's headquarters and they hand them this fancy rifle from their country. And then what it turned out to be was an AK-47, a bunch of them, which began to turn the tide in Lee's favor until he ran out of ammunition that they gave him, and you know, brass cartridges, yeah, hard time with those, you know. Anyway, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it, and you take care.
All right, sounds good. Bill, you take care of yourself. Good to hear from
you. Good to talk with you.
Okay. All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Our buddy Bill, calling from Cleveland, and that's a neat thing to be able to say after too long away. And yeah, how did Bill reach the program? Bill reached the program courtesy of the good offices of our friend Psychoticus. If you want to reach the program via phone, 304-574-8178, 304-574-8178. Break time coming. By the way, just a reminder, I hate to say this, but I don't think I'm ever going to say that an evening's fundraising has been taken care of ever again, because apparently no one has any. It would be awfully nice if Paul could get some company this evening, so that for one of those evenings when everything all, you know, dries up, that there might be a cushion, because it's gone right quiet this evening. I was hoping some folks might stand with Paul and with others who helped out along the way. I want to make sure that we get thanks out to John. John helped out over the course of the weekend. Thank you, John. And Terrace did as well. Thank you, Terrace. It all means a great deal, and it goes a very long way toward keeping all of this going. But anyway, we'll take a break and come back. This is the Memorial Day edition, 26th of May, 2014, of The Horn. And, let's just see what happens in the final hour, because Lord knows there's a bunch of stuff to cover. Among other things, like I said at the beginning, we've got some new innocent victims of the NRA to memorialize. But, Lord, the killing starts again, and the idiots come running. Well, it's like watching cockroaches scurry out from behind the baseboards. It's nasty. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. 8 minutes past the hour on this Memorial Day Monday, the 26th of May, 2014. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. If you want to get involved in the conversation, you are more than welcome to jump in. The angry Indian sending me a note via Skype. Just said, good show, my man. Thank you, brother. Thank you. Thank you very kindly. Let's see who we've got on the line here. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. How are you doing? How are you doing, Bob? This is Dave.
Hey, Dave. How are you?
Oh, wow. Yeah. Did you hear about our little water thing over here?
Little what?
We have a little water fiasco. And it tested the water positive for E. coli a few days ago, and we had to go it out for a couple of days. I thought about you. It was like a boil warning, or whatever they call it. And, it was pretty, kind of a little scary, I thought. I know. How long did you guys have to go without? Like weeks, didn't you?
With the water disaster in Charleston, we didn't, I wasn't in the affected area. They never went without. Understand the water crisis and maybe that tells the difference between good government and bad government. They never turned the system off in West Virginia. They just let people, they told people don't drink the water and then hope that they wouldn't.
Yeah, well, that's what they did here too. I mean, we still had the water was still running, but it had tested positive. It took them like 3 days to tell people too. So I didn't notice any ill effects or anything because I drink a lot of water. But I just it was kind of a scary thing. And I went down to the store and the bottled water was like completely sold out, cleaned out of it.
Oh yeah, and there's still there are still people in the Kanawha Valley who won't touch the stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Confidence in the public water system in the 9-county area served by West Virginia American Water is somewhere around 30%.
Yeesh. Yeah. I still have to flush my lines really because they said to run everything for at least 2 minutes. So, but. I don't.
Well, where did it come from? Where did it come from, Dave?
Well, you know, we've had these torrential downpours, these short torrential downpours. We had one around the 19th of May that was it was just like, you know, a half an inch of rain falls in 10 minutes or 15 minutes. And the streets just flood and everything. We had one about a year ago, too. And I think I'm just assuming that just overwhelmed the system. And some sewage, because I was down in the
right.
basement,
yeah.
And the drain was just going artesian, you know, it was coming out of the drain in the basement. And I was talking to a neighbor, and they said the same thing. So I'm sure that, you know, some of that sewer water just got into the freshwater system at some point somewhere.
I mean, these things do happen. At least some well-meaning corporation didn't dump a bunch of poopy into the Oregon into the Portland water supply.
No, actually, on the bright side, we just had an initiative. The election last Tuesday, we had an initiative where they wanted to privatize our water system, and people voted it down overwhelmingly. They did not want that. And it's a good thing. But in other news, hey, have you ever heard of the atheist experience?
Say again, please. You're a little muted to me, Dave. I don't know what.
Yeah. I'm not close enough to my speaker, probably. Have you ever heard of the atheist experience?
The atheist experience? I don't think so.
Yes, it's an online show which I highly recommend. It's out of Austin, Texas, but it's on the weekends too, so it's not in no competition.
Oh, is it a podcast or something?
Yeah, well, it's a podcast. It's on live stream on Ustream.
Okay,
but I came across one of their videos on YouTube, and I just so much got into this. I listened to this other guy called the Amazing Atheist, who's kind of funny, but both of these guys are, they're not two separate guys. One is a group, the Atheist Experience is a group, but the Amazing Atheist is just a single guy they're both highly intellectual, and the Amazing Atheist is hilarious, but, both shows I've just been, like, watching the heck out of I thought that it would be something you would enjoy. And maybe you're listening.
Oh, okay. I'm being reminded in the chat room by our buddy Horst that I played a clip from them on air about 2 years ago.
Yeah. They have one guy on the Atheist Experience by the name of Matt. I think his name is Matt Del Hunty or something like that. But he's razor sharp, and he is very, very smart. I think he went to seminary school before he became an atheist. So he just
There's nothing quite like seminary to bring out the atheist in a person. Or at least one with a functioning brain.
Yeah, I've heard about that. It's like Chris Hedges is like that too. He I think he went to seminary school too, and he's
But Chris still buys into the as far as I know, and if I'm misstating, I should be corrected. I think Chris still buys into the magic cracker and all of that stuff. My favorite example of that, and it's rather an extreme example, is a scholar by the name of Bart Ehrman. Ehrman, who got his bachelor's degree from the Moody Bible Institute. Okay, yeah, I mean that's real fundy business. And then was a good enough scholar to get accepted to the theology department at Princeton, where they started teaching him where Christianity actually comes from. And then he had his own curiosity lit up, and everything fell apart. I mean. I did a conversation with him way back in the early days of this program, and we were talking about some of the realities of Scripture, and I said, and so do the people in the pulpits on Sunday, have they learned this same stuff you're talking about? And he said, of course they have. I said, then they're deliberately misleading their congregations, or they're hustlers, or what? And I think his answer was yes.
Yes to all the above. Yeah, that's funny. They're excellent at the Atheist Experience. They're excellent at sowing doubt in people's minds. And they get calls from all different types of folks, but they get into some deep conversation, which is a lot of it's above me. They know a lot more about atheism and theology than I do, that's for sure. I'm learning a lot, though. I'm enjoying it. But anyway, that's all that's fit to print on that. I mean, I've enjoyed the show a lot, though. Definitely got to check it out. But
I'm being told in the chat room that it's a dandy program. My only problem, Dave, is the number of hours in a day.
Yeah, I understand. Well, so not much new other than that over here, other than my case is coming up real soon.
Oh, really?
In the court. Yeah, my trial for my house, for my foreclosure. So that's on the 27th of June. And, boy, it's tough. I'm having a tough time. They threw my case back from federal back to the state court, which I think is a fast track, but, I'm trying to keep the faith.
Well, that's all you can do at this point. Now, it'll be a big deal. The question is, will you get to a jury, or will you get procedurally bounced before you can get there?
No, I already tried for a trial by jury, and they turned that down. So I know I'm not going to do that. It's going to be in front of a judge, and if it goes down, I have to figure out something to do. I may be able to file a separate suit with in federal, just instead of what I was trying to do is to take my case over to federal, and that.
Oh my God, you're in. Oh, Dave, you're in a swamp.
I mean, you're in a swamp. I'm not saying, you know, abandon hope, all ye who enter here. And pro se litigants often get a bit of latitude from judges that they would not otherwise get. But I mean, it's an uphill climb, and I mean, I think you realize that.
Yeah. I'm going in eyes wide open. So I just I don't know. I'm going to try to get something going in the next. I've been looking for an attorney. I found a guy up in Seattle that's been pretty successful fighting these. At least I can maybe get a settlement from the bank, because they committed a lot of fraud in my case, on the paperwork, and all of this paperwork is fraud. It's all fraud. It's all, you know, fabricated, because they don't have they don't have the paperwork on most of these cases.
Well, if they cannot produce it, they cannot allude to it. But the problem is, you've got to have a lawyer there who's been trained in the means by which documentary evidence is handled, in order to make the argument that if they can't produce it, they can't use it.
Well, they produced it. It's just fraudulently produced. That's what it is, you know.
No. Oh, I mean, I think, okay, it. if we do this, we're going to go off into the weeds and we'll lose people who are otherwise paying attention. There's either can't produce it, and by produce I mean produce it in open court and according to the rules by which documents must be produced in open court as evidence, and then there's they produced it the wrong way, as in they made it up the wrong way. Or do you see what I'm saying? You know, words. In a legal context, Dave, words have meanings beyond the ordinary meanings of words.
Yes, I'm realizing that. I'm realizing that. But I'm trying to keep a good attitude about it, though, and I'm defiant till the end.
Good, be that way.
Yeah, I'm not. I've been in court with some other people that were just.
But you know, what's the purpose of the suit, Dave? Is it you suing somebody or somebody suing you? I'm trying to remember here.
They're suing me, but I did was I filed a counterclaim in federal, and now they kicked that back, so I may have to file a separate counterclaim or separate suit against people that are. Defrauded me.
But you've got to have federal jurisdiction too. I mean, you can't just go swanning into federal court. There's got to be a reason to be there.
Yes, absolutely. Well, it's violation of my right to due process and other issues too. There's other issues. I don't, again, like you said, I don't want to get into the weeds because it gets deep. But I have a number of federal issues. And so that's all that's going with that. But it's like we're heading into spring and summer here. It's starting to warm up. But except for these, like I say, these little torrential showers we'll get. And they're kind of
Are those typical of the time and the season for Portland, or is this more atypical?
Well, they do come sometimes, but they're not – usually is intense. The intensity is I have a rain barrel in the back in my backyard, and I emptied it out a couple of days ago, and it had, you know, 40 gallons in it today. So there was some rain last night, but it's just usually what we have here in Portland is like a slow, steady rain, and it's not as, you know, it won't be that intense. It won't be like the desert rain they have down south, where you have, you know, an inch or two a day, but
yeah,
you know, an inch in 15 minutes is unheard of, really. Anyway, so, well, it's good to talk to you again, and I don't know, maybe you want to get another call for the end of the day.
Well, it's good. It is good to hear from you too, Dave. And you know, I wasn't trying in any way to dissuade you from what you're doing, but just by way of
understanding the nature of the process. I mean, if one thing can be said of the American legal system is that it is always on the it is always presumptively on the side of the money.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I know that, and that's I've realized that from the start, and I've mentioned that in my, you know, in my case, in my pleadings too. I'd say, you know, I'm at a great disadvantage here. They have an army of lawyers, and I don't have, you know, unless I can find somebody who will represent me for a contingency or something. I'm in a lawyer.
Well, nobody's going to take a contract case on a contingency, especially because you're defending. Your best bet is legal aid. And I imagine you've probably already been down that road.
Yeah, I've talked to a number of people, but I this guy in Seattle, he actually has represented people I could get a settlement. I might be able to get a settlement and hold off, you know, the end game for a while too. So,
is he licensed in Oregon?
He's licensed in the Ninth Circuit, which is the same in Oregon and Washington.
Yeah, but that's not the same as being licensed in Oregon, Dave.
I know that. I have to talk to him some more about it.
Well, good luck. Yeah. And how far out are you?
How far out?
Time-wise?
A month.
Well, good luck. Good luck. Sincere good luck.
Yeah, thank you.
And keep us posted, please.
Sure will.
All right.
Okay, talk to you soon.
Take care, Dave. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Dave calling from what I didn't realize was supposed to be such a wet Portland this time of year. This is the downside of how we operate on this thing. We can only have one person dialing in at a time. It's not like the six-line hunt group that we have when the Comrex is not an otherwise humongous paperweight. The line is open, however, 304-574-8178. 304-574-8178. If you want to jump into the conversation, you are more than welcome to do so. It's about 26 minutes past the hour. And I want to thank Henry for jumping in with Paul from Fremont. And sort of trying to run out there in front of our attempt to keep this whole enterprise on the air. It's not an enterprise, undertaking. I'm trying to find the right word, but thank you. Okay, I'm just going to share this straight up. Jessica is listening, and she asks plainly, why doesn't he go to St. Andrew's Law Clinic or legal aid regarding Dave? Going into federal court pro se is insane. And, well, I think he got his counterclaim, which he tried to file in federal court, got bounced back into state court. But either way, a person in a circumstance similar to Dave's, you would hope, and of course there's been a long attempt, a long and ongoing attempt to make things like legal aid less and less and less available to people who desperately need it because of the way legal aid is funded. But that's the first thing that comes to mind for me. You either go to legal aid or you call the state bar and you say, tell me the list of people who take or point me toward the list of people who take pro bono cases regarding collections or what have you. That's how that works. So I state court or federal court, either one, going into court without a lawyer is like going into surgery with an accountant for a surgeon. And I'm not trying to be mean to the accountants, but the law is a specialized
intensely specialized realm of knowledge. And just something, I don't know how many people kind of went, what? When I was saying there's a difference between producing documents and producing documents, but there is. Producing documents is a function of discovery, producing documents as a means of introducing them into evidence in a trial. And then there's producing documents in terms of, you know, you hit the print button at the financial institution hits the print button, and a ream of fine print that can only be read with a goddamn electron microscope spits out of the printer. Most people, most non-lawyers, and hey, I'm a non-lawyer. I just happen to have had a cup of coffee in law school. Don't know that. Straight up, don't know that. We are about 30 minutes away, more or less, from the end of the program this evening. And where to go? It is Moran Monday, and it would be unfair not to have some Morans on Moran Monday. And there's nothing like another example of America's blood debt being paid by innocent people to bring out the morons. We start with a little bit of sanity before we go wandering off into the world of the moron. Oh, they're out there. Don't worry. They're out there. We'll get to them. We'll find them. You don't even have to look for them that hard. But there was pushback in the form of, and you can't, how do you give words to this except to let the words as spoken speak for themselves? Richard Martinez. His 20-year-old son, Christopher Michael Martinez, was gunned down Friday night in Isla Vista, California. He's part of the blood debt that the National Rifle Association and the paranoid gun goober fetishists insist be paid, but insist on never paying themselves. I was talking with Agnes yesterday, beginning, and you know how I am about things like curses and so forth, but you look at this and you wonder, wow, this franchise is kind of cursed. Agnes told me that the father, and he was agonized, of the shooter, Elliot Roger, that the father is a director or an assistant director or something inside the Hunger Games franchise. And, of course, the horrible overdose death of Philip Seymour Hoffman a couple of months back. Ugh. And Elliot Roger was running around out there talking about how people, you know, he was going to shoot people because women weren't having sex with him. I mean, there are multiple layers of conversation to be had here about the sense of male privilege for sex and how it plays out in terms of let's let Richard Martinez speak for himself, shall we? That seems the most appropriate thing.
Christopher Martinez, he was in the deli when bullets came flying in. Since then, his father, Richard, has been outspoken. He has been very emotional about the gun laws and politicians he says are responsible for repeated violence. CNN's Kyung Law had an opportunity to sit down with Mr. Martinez, who was incredibly emotional.
Really? You need to tell us that?
Child. He died on Friday. I'm 61 years old now. I'll never have another child. He's gone. So the reason I'm doing this right now is to try to see if we can do anything to make my son's death mean something. Because that's all we've got.
He's not going to grow up to be a man, to work in the world. What did we lose?
He was articulate, determined, nice, and tough. If there's all these things in the media about the shooter, and there's nothing about the victims, then it sends the wrong message. And that people need to understand that real people died here. And they need to know, put faces and names and histories to the people who died to make it real for them.
The politicians after Sandy Hook swore that they would do something.
We're all proud to be Americans. But what kind of a message does it send to the world when we have such a rudderless bunch of idiots in government? I can't tell you how angry I am. It's just awful. And no parent should have to go through this. No parent. To have a kid die because in this kind of a situation, what has changed? Have we learned nothing? These things are going to continue until somebody does something. So where the hell is the leadership? Where the hell is this, these people we elect to Congress that we spend so much money on? These people are getting rich sitting in Congress. And what do? They don't take care of our kids. My kid died because nobody responded to what occurred at Sandy Hook. Those parents lost little kids. It's bad enough that I lost my 20-year-old, but I had 20 years with my son. That's all I ever have. But those people lost their children at 6 and 7 years old. How do you think they feel? And who's talking to them now? Who's doing anything for them now? Who is standing up for those kids that died back then in an elementary school? Why wasn't something done? It's outrageous.
That man has more character and more courage than Wayne LaPierre will ever know in whatever remains of his sick, sorry, psychotic, sociopathic existence. You ever notice how it's not some goddamned NRA member's kid this happens to? How it's not some goddamn spawn of gun owners of America? No. Just some decent human being that has to die so that the weirdos of the National Rifle Association and gun owners of America can go off and masturbate with one hand on their and the other hand on their guns. And I despise them. One is tempted to say, guess what? There actually is a remedy for this stuff. There is. No one dare speak it. So that's the sane part. This furious, angry man with more integrity than Wayne LaPierre or at least 44% of the Senate of the United States. That's the sane guy who knows nothing but a level of grief that most of us hopefully will not know, but I suspect many of us already do. So the sane words of Mr. Martinez lead us to the moron portion of the program. Here we go. Strap in.
Just awful.
Oh, for some reason or another, that audio looped. No, really. Strap in.
This is not going to be easy. Trigger warnings, what have you. Tennis ball.
Protect our gun laws. Vote for Tony Strickland for Congress. Tony Strickland has a history of protecting our Second Amendment rights, and he won't get the same in Congress. Tony Strickland was a founding member of the NRA's Member Council and former California Rifle and Pistol Association Legislator of the Year. Tony has been a long-time supporter of the rights of citizens to keep and bear arms and will continue to oppose and actively fight any legislation that would take away our Second Amendment right to bear arms. As the founder of the Freedom Firearms Coalition and with the lifetime A rating from the NRA, we can count on Tony Strickland to protect our constitutional rights. On June 3rd, vote for Tony Strickland for Congress. The call of people by Strickland for Congress.
That, of course, is a robocall. And it may be the most offensive, disgusting, revolting, sickening, pustulent robocall ever produced. That's a Repiglican from California by the name of Tony Strickland, who's running for Congress from the 25th Congressional District. Okay? And Tony Strickland, as you heard, is a founding member of the NRA Member Council and former California Rifle and Pistol Association Legislator of the Year, Wolverines. And he will continue to oppose and actively fight any legislation that would keep a father's 20-year-old son from being gunned down at an effing deli. No. Actively fight any legislation that would take away our Second Amendment right to bear arms. As the founder of the Freedom Firearms Coalition with a lifetime A rating from the NRA, we can count on Tony Strickland to protect our constitutional rights. Yeah, you want to know what makes this extra sick? This was scheduled to run before the shooting took place. And even after the shooting took place, Tony Strickland's campaign did not have the scintilla of common decency required to reach out to the robocall political sales group and say, let's pretend, now not that we really do, but let's pretend that I have a modest amount of compassion for the people who got blown away in this latest latest submission of the butcher's bill to the innocent of America. Let's pretend that I have enough compassion not to run these things. So what say we don't run them? Nope. A spokesman for Tony Strickland said the robocall was scheduled before a 22-year-old killed 7 people and wounded 7 others Friday night in Isla Vista. A spokesman for Strickland told the Huffington Post that Strickland has sympathy for the victims and their families, although he declined to say whether the campaign would stop the robocalls. You know what? The 25th District of California covers part of northern Los Angeles County. Thank you, Sparky. Part of Ventura County. Includes the cities of Santa Clarita, Simi Valley, Palmdale, Lancaster, and the northern part of the San Fernando Valley. It's the most Republican congressional district to be located primarily in L.A. County. The district is represented by Republican Howard P. Buck McKeon. Well, if there's any decency at all in the California 25th Congressional District, this will put an end to Tony Strickland's political career because he's a psychopath. Like I said, this is the Moran part of the program. So let's run over now and check in, because we can. Oh, right. Anybody taking one for the team? Anybody heard whether or not Alex Jones has declared this a false flag operation to take away all our guns? Let's go to Radio Rwanda, Fox News. And one of those electric TV box psychologists who wants to explain to America why it was Elliot Rodger, who went on and on and on about not having sex and how he was going to kill people because of it. TV psychologist Dr. Robbie Ludwig wants us to know why he really squeezed the trigger. Oh, God, help me. Kind of glad I waited till almost the end of the program for this, because otherwise it just would have been 2 hours of screaming. And I like it better when the program isn't, you know, two additional hours of screaming. I mean, his parents saw the manifest and knew that something terrible was going to happen, and they were going crazy. Well, okay, let's not use that phrase. They were beyond the expression trying to find him before he did harm. And the manifesto is all about how he's tired of being in the friend zone, and he's a good guy, and why aren't the women having sex with him, and he's tired of seeing women running around with people he unilaterally declares to be unworthy of them. Sounds positively pre-Civil War, doesn't it? Yes, it does. And thus we get this.
41 additional clips for his 2.6 hours and his Glock 9mm. Well, that's 400 and something rounds.
There's no question.
Unbelievable.
He had over 400 remaining rounds left. But Robbie Ludwig, Dr. Robbie Ludwig, let me go to you. I started reading this 140-page manifesto, his plan of what he intended to do, and all of his suffering in the world, quote, has been at the hands of humanity, particularly women. And it's kind of interesting. He says, very shortly after my 7th birthday, the news came that my mother and father were getting a divorce. My life would change after this. Now, in this manifesto, he despises women.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on in this kid's head?
Well, it's so interesting. When I was first listening to him, I was like, oh, he's angry with women for rejecting him. And then I started to have a different idea. Is this somebody who's trying to fight against his homosexual impulses? Was he angry with women because they were taking away men from him? But this is a kid who couldn't connect and felt enraged and wanted to obliterate.
Honest to God, would you let anybody you cared about ever go to that woman for psychological help? The guy does 141 pages of how angry he is because he can't get laid by women, and so naturally, he's got to be gay. Because there has to just be something wrong with him. It can't be the fact that he had easy access to firearms. Oh, hell no. And she goes on, and I'm not going to make you listen to it. She says he's angry at the men for not choosing him. This was just a kid that was angry in general. He probably felt rejected. He couldn't connect. He couldn't feel loved. He couldn't feel successful. Maybe couldn't even feel like a real man. He had to feel like a real man. He had a real gun. Isn't that how we goddamn well define manhood in this country? You got a gun? Yeah, you're a man. By the way, thanks this evening to sorry, this thing just slows the hell down. Turns out this evening we have the Fraternity of Henry's Thanks to Henry for jumping in beside Henry, who's standing beside Paul from Fremont. And we're $45 to the good for fundraising beyond what Paul took care of on Friday night. Thank you. Thank you very much. This is painful. They're all painful. It's painful every time we realize that someone's son, someone's daughter, someone's husband, someone's wife, someone's Grammy, someone's dad, someone's mom, someone's grandpa, cousin, aunt, uncle, neighbor has been sacrificed for Wayne LaPierre and Ted Nugent. Really, how much must those bastards be worth insofar as blood debt is concerned? Because we've sacrificed a lot of good human beings for them. And exactly what sacrifice have they made for us? Yeah. Then there's Warner Todd Houston, who also has an explanation that doesn't involve easy access to firearms. I've never heard of this goober before. Warner Todd Houston, who writes over there at that place that rhymes with light and fart. And he, by God, understands Elliot Rodger. Maybe the right wing keeps doing this because they recognize that they have an internal murderer in them. And that there's something that just kind of plucks at their little heartstrings. So they try to give us the benefit of their greater comprehension. Warner Todd Houston writes the following. College is the time when everyone experiences those things such as the Iraq. No, such as sex and fun and pleasure. Jesus, this is in a video. It goes on and on and on, but we're not going to run it. Oh, no. I'm sorry. Those are the words of Elliot Rodger. No. Those are the words of Elliot Rodger. Sex is when it's sex and fun and pleasure. But in those years, I've had to rot in loneliness. This kid's driving a BMW, right? Yeah, some rotten. You girls have never been attracted to me. I don't know why you girls aren't attracted to me, but I will punish you all for it. So now, enter. Yeah, that's the video that's been pulled down, the YouTube screed, the manifesto, whatever. Enter right-wing freak Warner Todd Houston. He wants to explain to you non-serious people that college is not the time when everyone experiences those things such as sex and fun and pleasure. College is the time to learn, to study, and to prepare yourself for your life as an adult. It isn't a sexual playland where a guy should expect to act out a porn star fantasy. Colleges reinforce this idiocy with foolish anti-intellectual classes like porn studies, gay studies, and other such non-academic nonsense. I have a feeling we could probably introduce a major in Warner Todd Houston studies. This is the fault of America's worst generation, the yippies and other cretins from the 60s generation. And so this social misfit went to college with his daddy's big Hollywood money and expected that his every sexual fantasy would be fulfilled there. And why shouldn't he? That is what everyone has come to expect, isn't it? This is how college is thought of, isn't it? And then, of course, there's always the right-wing, conservative, low-wage argument. This guy argues that college educations should be eliminated as a prerequisite for most entry-level jobs so that there would be no mystique any longer attached to a college degree. All these clubs and absurd classes need to be eliminated. They're part of the root problem that caused this murder spree. Yeah. Wow. And then over at CNN, do we have time for this? Over at CNN, anchor Deborah Farrick tried to shut down any discussion of gun control. Actually, it's not gun control, it's murder control. It's mass shooting control. God almighty. I don't know. Let's see if we can wedge this in. Time grows short. But with any luck, maybe, just maybe. See, I don't think we should shut down debate. I just don't know what the hell is left to debate. Wayne LaPierre, Ted Nugent, and Larry Pratt of Gun Goobers of America have won. The deal has been made.
With this individual, specific to his discomfort in living every day, and a remedy to that problem. And there
you have to think that this is more than just disenfranchisement. This is a man who clearly had psychological issues. His family knew he had psychological issues. You don't simply look at somebody's YouTube and go, "Hey, ooh, this is troubling. I'm going to call police," unless there's a history of some sort of behavior that is no longer manageable. Holly Hughes, you've been in this situation, criminal defense lawyer.
You know, because he only went on a shooting rampage because he was crazy. Bullshit. He went on a shooting rampage because he had the requisite tools to go on a shooting rampage with. I mean, you don't go on a ball batting rampage unless you've got a ball bat. You don't go on a stone tool rampage unless you have some stone tools.
How do you deal with a young man who is on the verge?
Well, you try very hard. It's exactly what Lou said. You know, you need to be able to get them involuntarily committed and then see, have a workup done on them. What's more interesting to me is I think it's time to have a discussion about legislating some of the gun issues. Now, I'm not against having guns. It's a constitutional right. I own a firearm.
Stop that. You hear that? If you say you want some gun control, you immediately have to follow it up by saying, "But I'm okay with guns." Bullshit. Am I the only person out there who expresses this in terms of America having a blood debt to be paid, a butcher's bill that comes due randomly and brutally?
That's great. But the disconnect is, if there is somebody with legitimate mental health issues who's been institutionalized, who has been diagnosed, who is or should be on medication, is there a way that when you apply for a gun permit, we can give that gun shop owner access to those records?
How about we don't let people purchase a gun until they've passed a psychological? Again, this is the precautionary principle. You don't say, "Hey, let's do this and find out if anything goes wrong." You, "Hey, is this going to hurt anybody?" And then you do it. That's the precautionary principle. It applies in mountaintop removal. It also happens to apply in guns.
They're not going to tell the truth. And the laws that exist right now says you can't put it out there.
Here it comes.
This is an ongoing conversation, and it's one that's never going to be resolved. It's got to be about mental health and not firearms. Yeah. But I'm going to give Brian Claypool the last word.
Yeah, it's got to be about mental health and not firearms. I wonder if her NRA card is laminated, you know, with a little blood spatter design to it. Jesus, she nasty. Shorty, I'm sorry I got to your email too late, but thank you for it. Thanks very much to Henry and Henry, who got us very nearly to a third of the way done with tomorrow's fundraising. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff this evening, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thank you to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and AcheAct.org. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. And here comes Rick Smith on the horn.